Next case is 08-1942 and 08-2170, State of Ohio versus Raynell Robbins. Ms. Chase.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Melissa Chase, and I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney in Union County, Ohio. I am here today representing the state of Ohio, and that is my privilege in this matter. I am here along with Elizabeth Long, who is a deputy solicitor with the Ohio Attorney General's Office. We will be sharing the argument this morning. She will be speaking for 5 minutes during the state's time. I'd also like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal in this matter.
Watch your time closely there.
Thank you. As the court is aware, we're here on one of the issues is a certified question. And that certified question is, does the damaging of a private, singular telephone or cellular telephone disrupt public services sufficiently to constitute a violation of 2909.04A3? And the state would submit to the court that the answer to that question is yes. In this particular situation with Mr. Robinson,
Counsel, would it make a difference if one confiscated or took the batteries out of or some way impaired the ability of phone service before there was any attack?
Your Honor, the state's position is that it would not. In fact, there's a couple of cases which are not binding on this court, but I believe they came out of the 8th Appellate District.
I mean, here the person was making an effort to make a 911 call, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the middle of it. But you would apply the statute if someone came into the house and looked for the phones and hid all the phones or did something of that nature?
I would, Your Honor, because the statute, if you look at the plain meaning in the first section of subsection A, it says purposely by any means. So we are not limited just simply to tampering with or damaging a cell phone. And in fact, in the 8th Appellate District, the State versus Johnson case is basically very briefly, this involved the home being burglarized of an elderly woman. Two individuals came to her door posing as police officers. She let them in the house based on their false credentials. They burglarized her home, took personal property, and in fact, she never made any inclination, never expressed an intention of calling the police. They simply just removed the phone from her home. And the 8th Appellate District, whose opinions we're asking this court to consider, found that that was sufficient to impair the ability of law enforcement and first responders to respond to an emergency situation. So, now, yes, Your Honor.
The Third District looked at the discussion by the, there was a blue ribbon panel that did the whole House Bill 511, the whole rewrite of the criminal code, and they had all these notes in which they explained what they were seeking to accomplish with various sections. The take of the Third District was that the statute was really aimed at the mass communication and not the, when you drill down to the individual person who has an ability to connect into the mass communications network.
Yes, Your Honor, that was their analysis. We disagree with that, and we believe that when the third district took a look at this situation, their focus was on the A1 section and the A2 section. And a lot of those comments that they pointed to came from an analysis of those two first subsections, which, as the court is very aware, focus on mass communication in A1 and focus on public transportation and utility service to the public in A2. But if you look specifically at the language in A3, and Your Honor, with respect, we don't believe the third district should have even gotten to the issue of looking at legislative history and looking at the technical committee comments, because we believe that the language in A3 is plain and unambiguous. And in fact, that's something that the third district admitted in their opinion. They went on to do the analysis because they believe the three other districts who are contrary, who have decided cases like this contrary to them, were incorrect in what they
but
did.
But if you're using A3, then isn't it pretty hard to, that works for this case, but A3 doesn't seem to me helps you with your argument that if the telephones are hidden or put where the homeowner can't get to them, doesn't that have to come in under 1 instead of 3?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. They've actually, one of the courts that...
So for your case, A3 gets you there, in your view?
In our view, yes, it does. And we've got a situation, we believe this is an issue of incredible importance in the state of Ohio. Without trying to exaggerate the importance, I was at my desk yesterday and received a telephone call from a deputy sheriff who was responding to a domestic violence situation, was on the scene, and actually asked me specifically what was the charge that would be levied against the defendant who smashed a cellular telephone when the victim was attempting to call 911. The situation came to our attention yesterday, and I had to tell him, right now in the Third Appellate District, which covers 17 counties, that's not a crime. And the state believes that that's not a correct interpretation of the statute. Justice, you've pointed out the fact of the technical notes and the legislative history. We're going back to a statute that was enacted back in 1974. As everyone is well aware, the proliferation of cell phones, even of landline telephones, has exploded since that period of time. And I don't believe that I exaggerate when I say that a 911, the ability to make a 911 call for emergency response, that is oftentimes a lifeline between the victim and law enforcement. And that's the only way the victim is able to get help.
Counsel, as I understand the evidence here, there had been a 911 call already made, and we're talking about a second call that was interrupted by the destruction of the phone. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. Justice Lansinger, there was a first 911 call. That is the one that Mr. Robinson, Antonio Robinson, made where the cell phone was smashed. The two subsequent phone calls were made by the witness, Heather Hoag.
Okay, but wasn't there the question of the substantial impairment? I thought that the emergency folks were already there and that it was a subsequent phone call that was stopped by the activities here.
There was. The just to clarify, the medical personnel were dispatched with that first interrupted phone call, as were the police officers. The medical personnel were being held at the entrance to the Meadows subdivision or complex, apartment complex, because the police's job with respect to this is to go in and secure the premises so that medical assistance can be rendered to the victim safely. Because of the fact that first 911 call was interrupted, there was a second phone call made by Heather Hoag, which the court is referring to, that was a hang-up phone call after only a minute or so on the phone. There was also a third phone call made by Heather Hoag after that occurred, where the line was simply left open and no one said anything on Heather Hoag's end. So the dispatcher's information, all she could hear was noise happening in the background.
Well, am I correct that the significance of the interrupted phone call, the first phone call from the victim, was that the medical personnel and the police didn't know the address to which they should respond? Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's your point, I think, is that they could have gotten there quicker if the phone hadn't been damaged or hadn't been destroyed. if she'd been allowed to complete her call. Isn't that your point?
There's also other things that go along with that, because there's a great deal of information that the police did not have at that time because of the destruction of the cell phone. They didn't know what the status was on the victim, what the extent of his injuries were. They didn't know whether or not they were walking onto a scene that someone had a weapon. They didn't know whether the assault was still progressing. Those types of issues that are critical to police response and medical response were simply something that were unknown. They were left to, the two police officers who canvassed the neighborhood were left to drive around two different sections looking for anybody flagging down an officer, asking for assistance. And when that was not successful, the officers then had to, in essence, start again and look for witnesses, either witnesses to the assault or someone in that apartment complex who could tell them where this occurred and where the victim was.
The brief seemed to indicate that this really all occurred within 15 minutes or so, and that, in fact, there wasn't any real injury inflicted on anyone. And so how do you apply the substantially impair the ability? Is it what happens in fact or the potential that could have happened?
Your Honor, I think I'll answer your question, but I want to answer it properly. We believe, the state's position is, that the offense occurred the moment the phone was smashed. At that particular point in time, the ability of law enforcement and medical personnel to respond was substantially impaired by the lack of information that they had. The delay that was caused, whether it was short or whether it was long, is really a red herring. The statute, the A3 statute says, substantially impairs the ability of law enforcement to respond to an emergency. It does not say it substantially impairs the response time of law enforcement or first responders to the scene. We believe that is a very great distinction in this case. The act that is one of the elements of A3 occurred when that cell phone was smashed. So we believe any delay is in essence immaterial in this matter.
So you don't think that that's a factual case-by-case determination, substantial?
Oh, absolutely it is.
Substantial and imperial? That sounds like factual. Well, it sounded to me, in response to Justice Cupp's question, you were saying that if it's broken, if it's smashed, that's all.
I mean, no, Your Honor, I do believe it is a factual case-by-case determination. That's why we take issue with the Third District saying that the destruction is never a substantial impairment. We don't believe that that's a correct interpretation.
And in fact, after the phone was, the victim tried to call and the phone was smashed, he was beaten a second time, was he not?
Yes, he was.
So, okay, I thought.
And not supposing, I have no information that had law enforcement had the appropriate information, they could have prevented that, but that's certainly a factor to consider. And Justice Cupp, with respect to your argument about the injury.
That was my question, not an argument.
Sorry, you're absolutely right. Your question about the injury, we do believe this, as you know, the state indicted it originally on a felonious assault charge. And hindsight being 2020, I was the trial lawyer. I probably should have tried it on the felonious assault charge as well, because this issue about serious physical harm wouldn't have arisen had I done that. We believe there was serious physical harm. His lip was gashed open, hanging open. His teeth were, as they quoted, broken in his mouth or loose in his gums. And there was a great deal of blood that was on the scene. We had the belief that there was it was felonious assault.
Counsel, the separate concurring opinion of Judge Wilimanowski says that if you would have indicted under A1 and instead of A3, you wouldn't have been having this problem.
I'm not sure I understand that, Justice O'Connor, to be honest, because I have seen in the cases that I've reviewed, I've seen the 8th District and the 5th District that indicted under A1, and they didn't seem to have any problem under either section under very similar facts.
But A1 doesn't require a substantial impairment. It says just interrupt or impair television, radio, well, telephone is what we're talking about here. The communication being used for public service or emergency communications. So there is no degree that would have been necessary to be shown here, substantial versus maybe minimal or whatever. Is that, are you saying that that observation on behalf of Judge Wilimowski is not relevant?
No, I don't. I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. I do believe there's some relevancy in it. We charged it under the section we felt was most appropriate because of the presence of law enforcement and for the medical personnel. While this could be fit under the definition of an emergency communication under A1, you're absolutely right. That is an easier standard for the state to meet. But we felt the more specific crime was in the A3 section, which talks specifically about responding to an emergency and also protecting and preserving any person from serious physical harm. We felt that was the more specific, appropriate charge. Perhaps in hindsight, that might have been the better way to plead it.
Well, isn't the easier way always the better way?
You're down to 19, 18 seconds, 17, 16, 15,
Thank
if you want to leave any time at all. Ms. Long, do you wish to take a rebuttal now?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you, Your Honors. Perhaps there is one way the Third District did err in this case, and this court hit it on the head in the Isotoner case when it quoted the Chief Justice as saying, of the United States Supreme Court saying, if it's not necessary to decide more, it is necessary not to decide more. And with all due respect to opposing counsel, this whole idea that these police officers were just roaming around some giant apartment complex is just not true. This complex is about the size of a football field. What the testimony shows is is Officer Bartholomew showed up, did a, quote, quick circle around one part of the complex. That quick circle is around a row of parking spaces 12 spots wide. While he was doing that, Officer Collier shows up, or I apologize if I have the officer's name wrong, Officer Collier shows up, and on his way, it finds a witness to interview on his way to the upper part of the area. He describes that he interviewed that person, quote, very briefly. After Bartholomew does his quick circle, and while Collier is doing his very brief interview, Bartholomew drives up to right near where the incident was occurring, finds a witness, asks, where's this going on? He points
just
to the...
So your argument is, if the police can get there quickly despite the smashed phone, then 3 doesn't apply.
Correct.
And if you if they had indicted under A1, wouldn't you be here arguing that only applies to mass communications and A1 doesn't apply?
Right, then I'd be saying they should have, just as counsel said, possibly indicted this as felonious assault, as vandalism. And it's also not true that
Well, they lost their witness. He moved to Colorado and wouldn't come back.
They also had a witness that said that they saw it happening. They lost the victim. They also had a witness who was there watching the event occur. You don't need a victim to prosecute. You need a witness.
Okay, but if they had indicted under A1, would you be here arguing that does not apply to a smashed telephone because it only applies to mass communication?
Correct.
So that is not the easier route because you'd be making a stronger argument under A1.
I wouldn't say that's a stronger argument. Say it's a different, given the facts of this case, the substantial impairment argument, I'd suggest it's even stronger. But just because a defendant is not guilty of violating one very specific paragraph of the Ohio Revised Code doesn't mean he's not guilty of everything.
So are you saying that no smashed cell phone qualifies, or are you saying just under these fact patterns, because they got there quickly enough, there was not substantial impairment?
I'm actually making both those arguments in the alternative. Proposition law number one is defending the Court of Appeals position that a single sash cell phone can never constitute violation can never constitute disruption of public services. But even if it does, and quite frankly, I think the stronger argument is, and the narrow argument, which is what I suggest this case should be decided on, is that there was no substantial impairment here. The legislature put the word substantial before the word impairment here, where they didn't.
How would we apply the words, and you briefed this, but I want to hear your strongest argument on A3. Let's assume the facts are different. Just take the fact, we have to write law, as you know, very well know, that go beyond the facts in the case. And the argument, the Third District, is that 3 never applies. How does that fit with the wording of the statute? The word seems so clear to me.
And what has to happen is the best argument on proposition law number one, and I can see the proposition of law number two is stronger than one, is that looking at the statute as a whole, the legislature was seeking the general to protect the disruption of general public services. It's just, and that's quite frankly, I can't. And if this court looks at paragraph 3 in isolation of 1, 2, and 4, then I can see that paragraph 3 by itself would be.
I agree. There's a lot in the statute that goes to major telecommunications structures and so forth and equipment, but three then seems to bring it down to the transactional, the personal situation or circumstance where somebody's well-being is involved. It looks to me like they sort of, it's kind of an omnibus statute. They just threw in everything back in 1971 or 72. And now we have these words that we're applying in the next century. I just don't understand how we can. I guess your best answer is that we have to read it in context of perhaps that the reports to which Justice Pfeiffer referred and the other language. But the General Assembly knows how to, even back then they knew how to be very specific in what they wanted to say. It seems to me, well, not always, but usually.
I apologize, Your Honor. And there's a reason why I've been concentrating on propositional law number two and the more fact-specific arguments, and because I do when we're looking at the words very carefully, the second section of it all refer to impair. Well, the General Assembly added the word substantially here. Well, if we're looking at that section in the specific wording, then we have to, what does substantially mean? And respectfully, Robinson is not responsible for any delay in the police getting to the Meadows. The first phone call, everyone knew to get to the Meadows apartment complex.
But this is a factual argument, and it went to a jury, and the jury was obviously charged on this, and the jury found substantial impairment. And you can't reverse for that unless you have some major abuse of discretion. And where is the abuse? I mean, you have a version where if they was on the phone, he could have said, I'm at apartment C3, and they could have gotten there. Maybe they could have gotten there in time to defeat the second assault.
Actually, the person on the phone call, in the first phone call, said, I don't know which apartment I'm at. So in the fact they could have instantly come, that's not true either.
He could have said second building, third floor. There's a lot of things he could have given them, but he couldn't because his phone got smashed.
He didn't. But then the question, how much was he actually delayed? And it is possible, and it is, in fact, that's part of what this court allows appellate courts to do, is to look, is this evidence sufficient? The Court of Appeals, I don't believe, ever decided the manifest weight issue. So that issue is something hanging out there. But I also suggest if we're looking at these fact-specific issues and not the general legal proposition.
This Court of Appeals didn't reverse on substantial certainty, did it? It reversed on you can never have a cell phone qualified.
They did both. They said the Court of Appeals did both. They said under the general rule, they said, first of all, as a general rule, this never applies to single cell phones. Then they said, well, even if it did, the state never showed substantial impairment. That was in the Court of Appeals opinion. And that's my proposition.
That really isn't the question, though. Actual impairment, isn't it? It says substantially impair the ability of law enforcement or others to respond, not actually impair their response. And in this case, the person on the cell phone didn't give their address, didn't know where it was, but if they were able to stay on the cell phone and they heard the sirens coming, they'd be able to direct them to where they were, would they not? And so isn't this actually impair the ability of the law enforcement or emergency personnel to respond, as opposed to whether or not it actually affected the timing of their response?
Yes, but Your Honor left one important word out of there, and it's the critical word in the statute. Your Honor didn't say the word substantial. Yes, he did impair law enforcement. Yes, he did impair emergency services, but he did not substantially impair their ability.
If you can't direct them to where you're at, isn't that a substantial impairment?
If they can get close enough where they can do their job and no harm results, then it is not a substantial impairment.
All right, so this is really a results-oriented statute. That's your position?
Yes.
You can do anything that you want, but as long as they get there in a reasonable amount of time, then that's not a violation.
It's not a violation of this statute. It still may be felonious assault. It still may be vandalism. It still may be. And the false choice that the state is presenting this court is charging him with disruption of public services or walking free. That's a false choice. That is not the case. In some cases, maybe the slightly easier charge, maybe an additional charge they can add on. But this counsel for the state admitted that she could have charged this as an F2 felonious assault.
So, counsel, you're looking at this whole statute as a very system-wide prohibition. In other words, A, with the mass communications, B, with the transportation, and three, with the emergency services, talking about a substantial impairment that is purposely or knowingly accomplished by someone.
Correct. Okay. They must show, substantially impair the ability to respond. And here they did not substantially impair the ability of emergency services to respond. They showed up and using their, the state in their reply brief said I was making it up when I talked about briefly and quickly. No, those were the words of their officers. Their officer used the word briefly. Their officer used the word quick circle. That was their officer. And also, quite frankly, I've never contested that one of the victims' injuries were significant and his injuries were substantial. But the question was, did Mr. Robinson's actions in smashing the cell phone substantially impair the ability to get him treatment? And they never showed that the delay was significant enough to cause any significant delay in treating that victim. And I think that's a false choice, saying either the victim wasn't injured, the only way I can win is if I show the victim wasn't injured. No. And also, I want to point out that these facts, on pages 71 and 72 of the transcript, the second fight occurred immediately after that first phone call was disconnected. And the state asked Ms. Hogue, well, what happened next? I mean, after the cell phone was destroyed, so he started hitting him again, and while he was hitting him, that's when I called the police the second time. That's when the police were called the second time.
Counsel, given the opinion of the Third District, even if we agree with you that factually your defendant might not appropriately have Section 3 applied, they also essentially said Section 1 doesn't apply to the destruction of a cell phone. Now, if we disagree with that, even though it doesn't, in other words, if we disagree with that but agree with you on your limited argument, don't we still have to write and express our disagreement as to the application of Section 1, which apparently was written when people were still coming to town on horses?
Well, I think the answer is, first of all, if the court wishes to... Mr. Robinson is not concerned with which proposition he wins on. If this court rules for the state on one and rules for him on propositional law number two, he wins just the same otherwise. So if this court chooses to do that, he won't object to that. But secondly, I submitted the Durov case as additional authority to give this court an easier way of doing that. And as the state has pointed out, this is the only opinion that they've seen that's come to this position on propositional law number one. And this court can do what it did in Durov, is say, dismiss the cases improvidently allowed, but state that no, because the record doesn't support it, but say no one can cite the Court of Appeals opinion. If they did that, sir.
Counsel, with respect to the statute itself, I assume you would agree that your client is a person who purposely, by a means, or it says any means, and in this case he did damage, although apparently you don't have to damage the phone to be in the statute. So he intended to make it impossible to contact help by destroying the phone. You don't disagree with that. What you disagree with is that in this case he didn't substantially impair the ability of them to respond. And you're also not arguing that he gets off because there wasn't serious physical harm.
I'm not arguing that. I'm saying the evidence is sufficient for that. Your Honor, the state could sufficiently, the evidence is sufficient to show what Your Honor just said.
Okay.
And the point of propositional number two is a substantial impairment. The police had to get to the Meadows from where they ever were. Emergency services had to get to the Meadows from wherever they were when the call was made. Mr. Robinson is not responsible for that delay. He did not cause that delay. The only delay he caused is whatever delay they had once they reached the Meadows getting from the Meadows to the event that occurred. That's where he impaired their ability to act, and I'd argue the state did not prove that that was substantial, that that impairment was substantial.
Well, counsel, not only addressing your particular situation, but had the individual been on the cell phone and been able to not only direct, but provide other information that would have been asked by the dispatcher. Is the perpetrator still on the scene? Are there weapons involved? You know, those are the type of, I think, words or type of questions that go to the ability to respond, and also to protect and preserve any person or property from serious physical harm, not just the victim, but the officers and the emergency medical services that are responding. That's all part of the response, is to get the picture of what's happening there. And the paramedics couldn't show up to that scene, even had they beat the police there, until the police cleared it for them to come on site.
Well, that's in the abstract, that may be true, but there's no evidence in this case that the medics were delayed. One of the officers testified is that typically they have to clear the scene before the medics arrive, but we don't know how long. The state didn't present any evidence that the medics were actually delayed.
Would agree that the medics don't go in before the police clear the scene as a protocol matter.
There was evidence of that in this case as a general matter of protocol, but there was never any evidence that that happened in this case. And convictions aren't done in the abstract. Convictions are done based on the an individual's conduct and on the consequences of those conduct of that and on the individual consequences of that individual conduct. This is not just a general abstract matter. It's a specific facts, and the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Robinson substantially impaired law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hardwick. As long you have, I'll take 30 seconds.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Elizabeth Long on behalf of the Ohio Attorney General supporting the Union County Prosecutor. First, Mr. Hardwick has primarily argued about the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, but he's basically just disputing the jury's determination of a very fact-specific question. We gave great deference to the jury's determination on questions like this. And when evaluating a claim of insufficient evidence, this court views the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution and decides whether any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So there is no reason to reverse for insufficient evidence here, where there's ample evidence that has been discussed of substantial impairment that the jury could have reached this verdict based on.
Do we need to define the word substantially, in our opinion?
Your Honor, you do not need to define the word substantially. When the General Assembly declines to define a term, it's given the meaning generally understood in common usage. There's no need for a trial judge to define a term like that for the jury, and the jury is left to decide on a case-by-case basis whether a substantial impairment has occurred under A3 of this statute.
So a definition, a dictionary, we take a dictionary, anyone's choice of dictionary and use that as a definition.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is so even though the other two sections solely talk about impair. Was the jury given an instruction about substantially?
Your Honor, the jury was instructed that they needed to find a substantial impairment here. They were not told what substantial means. That was left to the jury to decide. But we do agree that the standard is different under A1 and A2 and under A3. And then otherwise, I would note that the plain language of A3 resolves the certified conflict question. In this case, the destruction of a single cell phone can amount to a disruption of public services under the statute. And the Ohio Attorney General respectfully asks this court to reverse the lower court's opinion.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.